This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, KCBX's Brian Reynolds speaks to Riley Newman, co-author of a new book about how local businesses can leverage their connect with their community.
When you're on Amazon, you buy something. But going down to the local boutique, you're looking and going right through the shelves. That's shopping. There's an experience there.
Also, my interview with Dr. Rhonda Beeman of the nonprofit Dreammakers Slow about her work helping fulfill the last wishes of terminally ill patients.
What we do doesn't just affect the dreamer. It affects all their friends and their family and their community.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, February 10th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with Working Lunch, a segment hosted by Jim D'Antona, CEO for the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, where each month he sits down with a member of our community to talk about doing business on the Central Coast. Today, he's speaking with Maureen Zawalik, Vice President of Business and Technical Services at PG&E's Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Working Lunch is a segment hosted on KCBX in partnership with San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and represents the views of the speakers and not necessarily those of KCBX. We should note that PG&E is a KCBX sponsor, but we cover them like we cover anyone else, and divergent viewpoints are welcome.
Today, I'm so pleased to be sitting down with Maureen Zawalik, the Vice President of Business and Technical Services at PG&E's Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Hello, Maureen. Thank you for being here today.
Hello, and thanks for inviting me.
So, Maureen has 35 years of experience in the utility industry. She joined the Pacific Gas and Electric team in 1997, and in her current role as the Vice President of Business and Technical Services at Diablo Canyon, California's last operating nuclear power plant, she's responsible for regulatory and compliance programs, procurement and nuclear fuel management, license renewal, emergency preparedness, cybersecurity, land and environmental stewardship, business planning, among many other things. So, Maureen, how does one find their way into the management of operations at a nuclear power plant? Guessing this isn't a line of work you started out shooting for in college. How did you end up here?
Great question. I get asked that a lot. I'm a nuclear engineer by degree, but you don't really have nuclear fuel purchasing 101 as your first year in college. You don't learn the details of navigating through complex regulatory proceedings and energy policies, but the nuclear engineering degree has helped. I started my career with Westinghouse Electric, which is the designer of nuclear reactors, including Diablo Canyon. And they had a great program going of an engineering rotation program, so leaving Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and come out to an operating nuclear plant and see how the tools and analysis are used, and then send someone from Diablo back to Pittsburgh to see how reactor designs are done and so forth. I just never went back. So 30 years later and raising two amazing daughters here, nothing against Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but man, I love Central Coast and San Luis Obispo. Since then, various roles in the list you said in regulatory and engineering and finance, business planning, and so forth, just increasing roles and responsibilities and leadership. PG&E is a great company to work for, invest in their team and their leaders. So we also had responsibility for hydroelectric, other forms of generation from PG&E. And it's just a great team. We're all dedicated to the safe operations at Diablo.
That seems like you got a decent trade there. So Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant has two nuclear reactors that help create the power. I know Diablo Canyon is one of the most important producers of energy in the state of California. With both reactors going at an optimal level, how much power comes from the plant? Like, how many houses does it affect?
We safely generate about 9% of the state's power that comes from Diablo Canyon. And we're the largest generating facility in California and the largest clean generating facility in California. We make up about 20% of California's clean energy, and we are the most reliable source of power in the state. You asked about how many homes. It's really about 3 million Californians, 3 million people. We're available 24/7, 365 days a year. It's baseload power is what they call it. Last year, those two units, 2.3 gigawatts, had a capacity factor well over 93%. You know, unlike intermittent sources of clean energy sources that are in the 20% range, it's important to have a mix of all clean energy. It can't just be nuclear or wind or solar or hydro, but it's got to be a mix. I was just pointing out the reliability of Diablo, and that reliability for approximately 3 million Californians says a lot when the need for power. So that's why the state asks us to continue our operations, as it's an essential energy facility. And we have always and will continue to operate Diablo Canyon with excellent safe operations. So we remain ready if the state wants to call upon us again.
I couldn't even imagine that kind of coming offline with all the things we're doing to electrify. In fact, one of those reactors was technically scheduled to shut down last year. The other one was scheduled to close this year. The state of California took action in 2022 with Senate Bill 846. At the end of 2023, with the California Public Utilities Commission approving a new retirement date in 2030. So you talked about that piece where you've stepped up and said, you know, we're willing to keep doing what you guys need us to do. Can you bring us up to speed of where we are in the status of the permitted use of these nuclear reactors?
That's a great question. So after Senate Bill 846 was signed by the governor in September of 2022, we submitted a comprehensive license renewal application to the federal government, the federal safety regulator. That's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. If I say NRC and onward, it just kind of flows. We submitted that in November of 2023. The NRC process to renew licenses is a 20-year license renewal process. It's all on track for approval for later this year, which is great. We are also governed by the state of California. So we kind of have two paths or two levers, right? They've only asked us for 5 years so far. For instance, as you mentioned, the California Public Utility Commission approved our new retirement dates to be 2029 for Unit 1 and 2030 for Unit 2. And they approve our annual funding as well. So that's what they control, the CPUC. The California State Lands Commission, another example, controls our leases for our ocean intake and discharge. So they've approved us till 2030. So those are just a couple examples. But obtaining a 20-year approval from the federal government provides that maximum optionality for the state to see what energy needs might be as we get in the next 3-4 years. We're one of the last plants to submit that 20-year license renewal application. Original license are for 40 years, 40. Then the next license renewal is 20 years. And there's a dozen plants that are getting subsequent license renewals for 20 more. So 80 total years. So not forever, but, you know, a long time.
So let's talk about this kind of 180-degree turn that the state of California and the federal government threw at you in September of 22 and asked you to implement in 24. Here was a facility that's been scheduled to power down, has an entire community panel working on decommissioning the plant. I got here right about that time. Probably had prepared staff and operations to take one of the reactors offline in 24. I'm sure there are those who are concerned about the safety and maintenance of the reactors, given the direction you and PG&E were given to cease operations. What's been happening regarding the maintenance and operations with that kind of policy reversal?
I'll first talk about the people. We're the largest private employer in SLO County, which is outstanding. And in 2022, you're right, our staff was continuing to prepare for shutting down Unit 1, which should have shut down November of 2024. And then we got the call from the state. It was a great call to get, by the way. And the pivot began. We called ourselves Team Pivot. And just a dedicated, committed to safe and reliable operations, proud members of our community, energized getting that call. In fact, our top tenet right now that we live by is we earn the right to continue operating Diablo Canyon each day. We hired over 300 more people in that 2-year time frame. So head of household jobs, helping the community and so forth. And then regarding, you know, safety and maintenance, I always talk about seismic first. People correlate to that. So Diablo Canyon is seismically safe. It's designed for seismic activity that is well beyond what we can experience here. You know, like during the San Simeon 2003 earthquake, it greatly affected the region and sadly claimed 2 lives. The facility at Diablo experienced minor water sloshing in a tank. That was it. It's a top responsibility. Safety is for PG&E and Diablo. We've done extensive reevaluations of everything. We maintain like a long-term seismic program like no one else has in the United States. So it's the most studied region, if you will. And then on maintenance, first thing I say on maintenance is we have met all required maintenance on the plant systems. If we did not, then the NRC would not allow us to operate. We have 2 NRC employees, resident inspectors, 24/7, unfettered, at the plant all the time. Well, they're not there 24/7, but they can be there 24/7. And they're constantly doing inspections and looking for things on top of over 2,000 hours of additional inspections by the NRC. And then just finally to share, we're the only plant in the country that has an independent safety committee, Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. And they are inspecting and on-site and interviewing, walking down the plant, public meetings so the public can participate in that and understand. So just sharing an overall the status of where we are from a seismic and operation and maintenance standpoint.
Well, I think that's interesting what you talked about there and bringing on 300 new employees. I'm sure folks who were maybe on the verge of like, well, I'm going to be done here shortly. 5 year doesn't seem like a problem. But for someone, maybe a young person who may want to get into the work that you're doing, does that pose a problem? Or was that, yeah, we just told them like, hey, this is what we know. This is what it could be. Do you know how that kind of happened or what?
Yeah. No, it was incredible how many people wanted to come to Diablo and help and support this effort. New career, mid-career, and later in career. New to nuclear, nuclear experienced. And that was outstanding. And we had some retirees come back to do some mentoring. But we had no problems hiring. We also offer a retention, which is helpful because we are asking someone to go uplift their lives and move to Central Coast. And Central Coast is pretty cool to live here. See my previous statement. But we had a comprehensive retraining, redeployment for our employees when we were going to be shutting down in 2024. And we'll continue that if our future is only 5 years.
If you're just joining us, I'm Jim D'Antona from the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and this is Working Lunch on KCBX. And we are here with Maureen Zawalik of Pacific Gas and Electric, and we are talking about Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Does the state of California or the federal government recognize nuclear power as a green energy source?
Well, for the state of California, unfortunately, no. The California Senate Bill 100 established a landmark policy requiring renewable energy and zero carbon resources, we are that, to supply 100% of electric retail sale to end-use customers by 2045. And unfortunately, the language in that bill excludes nuclear and large hydro.
But small hydro would qualify?
Yeah, I think it's under 25 megawatts.
So
yeah.
And that's interesting to think that certainly in the state of California, that water is a renewable as we are trying to keep that going. But I think our idea is that if we're trying to, you know, deal with climate change, nuclear does that in spades and does it in a very safe way. So that's kind of surprising, but...
Well, the need for power, water, and public safety has never been more important now than ever. I mean, the wildfires and all of that, it's catastrophic. It's devastating. So I'm hopeful the state will reevaluate the current energy policies, and that'll take a collective effort of supporters of clean nuclear energy, you know, to help with that. The California Energy Commission does annual periodic reports on the reliability needs, and their most recent report stated that new projects will have to come online faster than recent unprecedented bill to make up for the shortfall that would come from Diablo's closure. And if Diablo closes, they could bring on, you know, what happened on San Onofre, fossil fuel generation in its energy portfolio and moving the state backwards on its clean energy goals.
Do I understand it correctly? The state of California has had a nearly 50-year ban on permitting and construction of new nuclear power plants.
That's correct.
So it seems that it's not because of the quote-unquote danger of nuclear power, a carbon-free energy source, but it's really dealing with the storage and disposal of spent nuclear fuel. Is that...
Yeah, just some background. So California's moratorium on new nuclear was since 1976, and there was two parts of it. It said no more new nuclear build until, one, there's a technology for reprocessing used nuclear fuel assemblies, and, two, there is a permanent disposal of high-level nuclear waste. All the nuclear plants in the U.S. have interim storage. We have one, you know, all of them. And, in fact, it's those two conditions that have created that moratorium that we need to work through. And, again, that could be another thing we collectively work through with supporters of clean nuclear energy. You know, because it's essential, again, like I said, to have a mix of clean energy sources that is continuing to include nuclear. I think when you opened up, you said the last operating nuclear power plant in California. I've added the word currently. The last. So the momentum and support for clean nuclear energy is polling very well. Majority of Americans right now are showing 56% support of that. And in California, I've seen numbers recently of over 60%. So that's promising. And that it's also a bipartisan support and issue right now. And it's vital to the state's reliable and clean energy future.
You talked about interim storage. So that would take place on Diablo Canyon site?
Yes, in two types of interim storage. One is called wet storage in the spent fuel pools. So after a fuel assembly, like I mentioned, is in the reactor, the nuclear reactor core, for about 4.5 years, it then gets moved to the wet storage in the spent fuel pools for about 7 to 10 years. And then we have a interim independent storage facility about 310 feet above sea level that's dry storage. And that's where we have the rest of the storage. They have a concrete pad that can store the spent fuel up there.
We have a ban, but what about the rest of the United States? Are we seeing any new nuclear power plants coming online? Did I see it right that Pennsylvania is reopening Three Mile Island nuclear power plant?
You sure did. Then they're renaming it to honor one of their previous chief nuclear officers or executives. So it's called the Crane Clean Energy Facility. They have been doing Herculean efforts on their pivot and restarting those efforts.
And a lot of those I hear are being set up because of the need for data centers, for the amazing amount of power that are being kind of pulled out of that. Do we see that as a trend? Is there more happening where there are new ones are coming online or repowering of those?
Yeah, absolutely. Between data centers, AI, tech, and more, the companies are looking at reliable, high capacity factor base load power because they need power all the time. So they've looked at nuclear. And so there was about 4 or 5 announcements last year. You mentioned the one with TMI, and that was with Constellation and with Microsoft in Philadelphia. There was also a big one in Energy Northwest in Washington with small modular reactor designs and partnering with AWS on that. Talon, Susquehanna, another Pennsylvania, currently operating a 960-megawatt unit, which is like one of Diablo, is partnered with AWS on that. So a lot of great examples and restarts that are going on.
Beyond the important production of energy, how many people are employed in Diablo Canyon and all its operational pieces?
There's about 1,200 people employed at Diablo Canyon all the time. And then during scheduled refueling and maintenance outages, we bring in about 1,000 temporary workers to this area in this community.
And so what other types of work are employed up at Diablo that aren't technically nuclear power folks?
You don't need to have a nuclear engineering degree to work at Diablo Canyon. We have lots of opportunities and different types of work at Diablo, including things like finance, communications, different engineering fields, trades like welding, electrical, instrumentation technicians, of course, operators, security officers. We're like our own little city and village out there. So we have like our own security police force. We have our own fire department, you mentioned, medical team. We have a strong partnership with Cal Poly that helps bolster our pipeline. And we do internships and provide labs and equipment and degrees and student projects and things like that. So that's a great local partnership between the two organizations.
Yeah. And you have probably one of the original desalination plants on the coast to work through that cooling system for the reactor, right?
That is correct. The desalination plant, water treatment plant that we have out there, it's basically used for 99% of all of our water needs to operate the plant. Think about the tanks and the water sources and all that. And it also supports all of our potable needs as well. On average, we use less than about 50% of its current capacity, and we have had emergency water use agreements with the county and are further looking at uses for that additional capacity, especially in the need of so much water these days.
It's certainly something we were interested in the chamber side. We've taken groups down to different places, certainly seen yours, because that is obviously an asset if it came down to it. But again, we have that opportunity because Diablo Canyon's right there. If folks wanted to learn more about the work happening at Diablo or PG&E, what's the best way for them to learn about that?
Lots of options. We run an extensive tour program. We took about 1,800 community members to the plant in 2024 alone. And we have a great Instagram where we highlight our environmental stewardship, employees, coming events like hiring fairs or NRC public meetings. We have it in Spanish as well. And then we have a speakers bureau. So we'll bring the plant to you. If you're in a Rotary or a social club or a church or a member of a homeowners association, please contact us and we'd love to come give you an overview of what's going on and answer any of your questions.
So, Maureen, thank you so much for taking the time out of your incredibly busy schedule and joining us today to share some of your work with us.
That was Maureen Zawalik, Vice President of Business and Technical Services at PG&E's Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, speaking with Jim D'Antona, host of Working Lunch and CEO of San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. PG&E is a KCBX sponsor, but we cover them like we cover anyone else. Divergent viewpoints are welcome. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Up next, Brian Reynolds speaks to Riley Newman, co-author with Scott Saunders of Brandy, 101 Sips of Wisdom for Attaining a Successful Brand.
Hello, I'm Brian Reynolds. Today we are joined by Riley Newman, founder and brand strategist at Motif Brands. Welcome, Riley.
Thank you.
You know, we're sitting here in KCBX Studios, and I did bring a bottle of brandy. I forgot the snifters, but you know, we're not going to be talking about alcohol today.
We're talking about brands
and branding, correct?
Yes.
But what led me astray a little bit, I only read part of the title of your brand new book, Brandy, 101 Sips of Wisdom for Attaining a Successful Brand by Riley Newman and Scott Saunders. That's your partner there at Motif Brands.
Right, yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book with your friend Scott?
Yeah, so our background goes into brand and marketing and really helping businesses focus on the marketing of going, okay, you can spend all the money you want on marketing and advertising, but really going back to it, you have to have a brand in place. You have to be distinct. You have to stand out. And helping businesses really discover that, whether it's a small business that's just getting started or someone who's, you know, medium-sized or even large who has years of experience. Like, brand really is that cornerstone of the business. And so after all these years of experience of working with businesses, we really wanted to boil down or really distill down our insights into these, what we call SIPs, 101 SIPs of kind of, you know, just things that we've learned and what we usually do have to teach clients over and over, but going, hey, let's just make this so this is a book that someone can sit down while they're drinking their coffee or a glass of wine and be able to flip through it and, you know, read them here and there.
As a psychology fan and a student of psychology, that most people learn most of the time in a story format.
Right.
So short snippets of information that are constructed with a beginning, a middle, and an end are powerful. What is your background? I mean, did you guys work in industry or advertising?
So my background comes from mainly in design and then went into strategy and be able to look at that on the brand side of things. That's really where I fell in love because I love human behavior just like you and psychology and just what makes them buy something. Why do they choose this brand over this brand? And really trying to understand that because the human mind is fascinating. It's not rational. and so the irrationality of our purchases and really the emotional and romanticizing we do with brands, I've always been fascinated by that. Scott's background, he went to Cal Poly and he actually, you know, has 30 plus years under his belt of design and winning awards in that field. And he comes from an art and design background. And so, you know, us together is just kind of this really nice cocktail of the strategy met with design, and we just help elevate these businesses. We like to say that it helps them go beyond business because business is transactional and brand is relational. And so really helping them break outside of that cap that either their business or their industry puts on them and helping brand really kind of open up a whole new world to them.
Some of the common questions that you've gotten about what you do is like, what is a brand or when and how should I rebrand my business? How might it help?
Yeah.
Can you explain that in just a few words?
Right. The brand, it's not something tangible. It's not something that you're going to see an ROI on immediately. It's not something you can track. It is perception. It's the gray area. And that's what makes it so magical and this kind of device that businesses can invest in to really go, okay, how are we perceived? How are we viewed? Is that aligned with where we want to go and where the opportunity is in the market for them to succeed? And most importantly, does it align with their strengths as a business?
Is it safe to say, and I think the answer is going to be yes, but just tease this out, that when you're inside of a business, maybe you're familiar with it, maybe you founded the business, but almost by definition, you don't have a perspective of the business and or its brand because you're inside, and that to get that outside look, that outside perspective, you need outside help?
it's kind of like when you know how the sausage is made, you kind of start to, it's like the curse of knowledge where it's, you're inside your industry. It's the day in and day out. It's the, you know, it's mundane and you're just kind of losing that perspective of going, okay, how do people actually view our industry? We wrote about it in Brandy and it is being inside the jar. You don't see your label anymore. You just see the ingredients. You know, if it's peanut butter, you know, it's just mashed up peanuts, right? And some oil or whatever could be in there, maybe a dash of salt. But from the outside, the consumer sees peanut butter, for example, as, oh, it's a solution to whatever, a sandwich or a snack or a treat, where you're able to then positioning and helping to frame what the business is to the benefit of the customer.
Some of the misconceptions that you're confronted with that we can discuss, that rebranding is merely getting a new logo.
Yeah.
Marketing, advertising is a brand, and confusing awareness of a product or service with its brand. Can you straighten that out for us?
So especially on the Central Coast, we've had a lot of businesses where they're just dumping tons of money into marketing and advertising. They're going through the motions, but it's not actually making a difference, not moving the needle. And they kind of get stuck in this spiral because really it's like you got the cart before the horse. The brand needs to be there to really absorb the impressions you're collecting with your marketing and advertising efforts. And so that's usually a huge kind of red flag immediately with some businesses. And with rebranding, when they go, okay, it's time to rebrand, they're either getting bored with their current logo and just they think this is going to be this silver bullet. And they go, we just need a new logo. That's what we need to do. And unfortunately, that's not the answer. And rebranding is much more, there needs to be a why. There's got to be a reason that goes into the strategy and what you're trying to reposition or perhaps even help manage the perception. And that's going to give reason to why you're rebranding. Why are you changing the logo? Why are you making these adjustments and adapting the brand and helping the business either evolve and having that purpose kind of as the core? And that's going to give direction to everything and have the strategy actually make sense, because everything else is tactical. You know, design, marketing, advertising, those are all tactics, but you do need a strategy to help direct.
And how would you define in just a few words a strategy to either enforce the brand you have or acquire a new one? What is that? Strategy is usually a medium to longer term set of goals. Is that accurate or more or less?
So my definition would be, okay, we're trying to achieve this certain objective. What is that in a 10-year, 5-year plan? And then be able to go, what are these steps along the way? Where a strategy, we actually write about it in Brandy and we talk about it on our podcast, where strategy is able to adapt and change. It's really the not a specific roadmap, but the goals and objectives and kind of stepping stones along the way can kind of help. Those can change and adapt depending on, you know, market shifts or pandemics or whatever it could be that come out of nowhere. But the strategy can keep the trajectory. So it's really having that vision of going, okay, where's the puck going? How do we start skating towards that? Whether it's in your market as a business or even just you start seeing changes in the consumer behavior, because that's going to shift the market. So just kind of keep an impulse on those things.
There's one of my favorite novelists, Lee Child. His character, Reacher, is former military policeman. And he's, of course, everybody's hero getting the bad guys. And one of his maxims is no plan worth anything survives first contact.
Yeah,
like, so you've got to be nimble, I suppose, too.
Yeah. And that's like is it Muhammad Ali or Mike Tyson? Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Well, you know, society from, say, 100 years ago, where the touchstone, I think, in product advertising was value. If you bought something, a washing machine, a razor blade, you know, it lasted a long time. It was a good product for good money. Mm-hmm. But over time, it shifted to a more psychological approach to helping people cope better, feel better about themselves and so forth, smoking the right brand of cigarettes, God help us, or you know, driving the right kind of a car. But there's a psychological phenomenon here that I find super interesting. And actually, in your book, you use the word a brand has a mindset. Tell me about that.
It's like you said, over these years, you did have products were sold based off of functions. Then it turned into, you know, the benefits of a product. And then now we're in this world where it is psychological. It's lifestyle. It's not only someone's internal narrative, which like you said with the Marlboro man, it's like, I want to be viewed like that. I want to be viewed. So you smoke these cigarettes or whatever it could be. Now you do have that where the brand, how it's portraying and it's kind of the idea and view of the world that aligns with the audience. So someone's going to drive a Volkswagen or a Subaru or a Ford based off of them going, yeah, that brand aligns with how I see the world, how I want to be portrayed. And most importantly, it reaffirms that internal narrative that they have, because if that gets dashed to the wayside and a brand goes, no, that's not how the world works, we can't handle that. So a brand that aligns with a certain audience and going, hey, we see you, we see the world similarly, we are akin, then someone can align with that.
It's absolutely not trying to be everything to everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's a huge point in the book, is just like, hey, if you're everything to everyone, you're diluting what you actually mean.
I am Brian Reynolds on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we're joined by Riley Newman, co-founder and brand strategist at Motif Brands. You know, Riley, one of the things that I find fascinating about advertising is that it needs to be on the cutting edge of the human experience. And by that, I mean not too far ahead of current values and priorities, and certainly not behind. And the pace of life makes that hard. We're inundated with information. And I think sometimes people will habituate to products and services merely because they don't have to think about something new or different.
Right.
But one of the aspects of the book that I found fascinating was the idea of the personal relationship and how that is acquired and nurtured over time between the business and the customers. And it seems to me that one of the worries, a legitimate worries that local business people have, is that they're being driven out of the market by pricing or convenience or free shipping by online retailers. Local business has the opportunity to develop those relationships in ways that businesses that are located far away do not. How do you feel about that?
That's what I actually encourage a lot of businesses around here, is that, yeah, okay, you do have Amazon, you do have these other massive companies that are technically an alternative option, so they are competition, but you have the advantage, like you said, to having that human touch, to being investing in those relationships. Yes, the business is transactions. The business has to be profitable to survive, but the brand allows those relationships to really kind of just, you can nurture them and grow them, where you do understand who they are as an individual, and you're able to then, you know, really dive into going, okay, this is who our customer is, and you can invest back into them. And so even with the book, it's like everything about it is about being empathetic. You get in the mind of your audience. You start understanding, hey, how do they feel in these certain situations? How do they feel right now during this time? And understanding their purchase needs and what they're trying to do and accomplish. And that could be relieving a pain or an aspiration that they have. And, you know, in Brandy, it's like the human touch, when we do focus on that, it's going, yes, that is the experience. That's what someone's going to remember. They're not going to remember a transaction. I was just talking to this guy, and we were talking about how Amazon, yes, buying is one thing. Shopping is a totally different experience. And so keeping that in mind, going, yes, when you're on Amazon, you buy something. You don't really shop. But going down to the local boutique and you're looking and kind of, you know, going right through the shelves, that's shopping. There's an experience there.
Yeah, the cognitive variables are quite different. May we have one of the sips from the Book of Brandy?
Oh, yes. We'll start with sip number one. And this one is a fan favorite. Brand clarity drives brand confidence. Confidence doesn't come from being everything to everyone. A strong business typically will have strong leadership. A strong business will be an individual or a group of professionals who are confident in their direction and each step they make along the way. They are confident when they say the name of their business, when someone asks, and bold when describing their collective mission. Unfortunately, this feeling of certainty doesn't naturally come when owning and running a business. Through brand clarity, focus is discovered and fortified. This focus will create a natural increase in confidence through the empowering attributes that have now been made clear for the business as a whole. And kind of wrapping up that sip, confidence doesn't come from being everything to everyone, but emerges from the willingness to have clarity and be that one thing for some. This self-awareness and brand clarity is your most important asset. It's your confidence.
One of the elements in the book I read, and I'm not a businessman. I've always worked in the public. Well, I've worked in private sector too, but my main career was in public sector and in the government. And we weren't as concerned with, you know, brand loyalty or whatever. There's only one library in town, and people got to come back. But yeah. One of my issues as a student of, you know, call it cognitive psychology, is we're overwhelmed with information. We're drowning in it. Our brain normally, what it does is reject irrelevant data and irrelevant stimuli to focus on what appears to be the beginnings of a story that we can tell ourselves and then, you know, help us understand and cope with the world. But one of the elements has got to be, in terms of this inundation of information and stimuli to people, how to stand out.
Yes.
How to be different. and of course more valuable, but how to distinguish yourself from others. And it seems to me that that's part and parcel of what the brand is about. Could you elaborate on that a little?
Yeah. And we write about this in Brandy where, okay, so a herd mentality is a lot of what businesses will do where they go, oh, these, you know, my competition's doing this or the market's doing this. I need to follow suit. It's a knee-jerk reaction. It's not responsive. It's reactionary. And so you see this a lot in the market. And then the brands that do succeed are the ones who are being distinct. They're being unique and they're leading into their strengths and standing out. And the example we give is like a school of fish. The school of fish stays together to not be eaten by the shark. It confuses them just like zebras do the same thing. Any herd. Yet in business, you want to be the one who is eaten. You want the shark to get you. So being in the school of fish, being with all the other businesses, just doing what the market's doing, really is counterintuitive. And yet it is our natural biology to think that. That's evolutionarily, like, yes, we do think that way. We need to survive. We need to stay together. But in business, in brand, it's kind of opposite world where you do want to be the one who stands out. You do want to be the one that gets chosen. And so having that strength to really be bold and lean into what makes you distinct, that's what the brand needs to rely on. That's the power.
I was just thinking of a ballroom where people are dancing together and some are strangers, some are known friends and so forth. But you're standing on the sidelines hoping that somebody's going to ask you to dance. And do you want to blend into the wallflower thing or do you want to stand out and be noticed? Let's assume that you had an initial meeting with a business. What would be the punchline to your presentation on why they should look at either creating a brand or a different brand?
Typically, there's a pain that they have, and they're wanting growth. And so we have to define what growth is for that specific business. Typically, you know, it's low profitability, or they're just wanting to grow their market share. And so understanding how does this aspiration they have, or perhaps a pain, how can brand help them in this? And brand, to me, is one of the greatest levers a business can have in tandem with having a pricing strategy. It can do miracles for a business. And so helping them understand, going, okay, this can actually help you achieve these certain things and can be rather cost effective. It's almost like the Midas touch, where you can take something that's pretty standard and commodity and be able to then reframe it and repackage it and really position it in a new light that's going to breathe fresh air into the business or find a whole new market or just really niche down into a buyer who does appreciate it. So really, every client's so different. There's really not this mold that we go by that really is like, okay, run every business through this process and it's the same thing. It's not cookie cutter, but it's much more in depth because like you said, it's about being distinct. So every business therefore can't go through the same thing. It's their own transformational process of taking them beyond just the business transaction into this kind of enchanting world of brand where now they're able to do what they love, lean into what makes them special, and then charge what's appropriate for that.
What blew me away, I mean, there's many things in the book that blew me away, but one of them was, call it sort of an algorithm, that if you want to be more profitable, which everybody does, price is the key to everything. Mm-hmm. And if you are able to increase your commodity, your widget, by 1%, that it tends to dwarf other things you could do, such as reducing production costs or increasing volume of sales. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that just makes a lot of sense.
Right.
I am Brian Reynolds. Today we were joined by Riley Newman, co-founder and brand strategist at Motif Brands, and discussing his new book with his partner, Scott Saunders, Brandy, 101 Sips of Wisdom for Attaining a Successful Brand. Thank you, Riley.
Thank you.
This is KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Meher Ali. Up next, my interview with Dr. Rhonda Beeman, executive director of the nonprofit Dreammakers Slow. Dr. Beeman is also a Cal Poly professor, author, TEDx speaker, and head of peak learning. Dreammakers Slow fulfill the final wishes of terminally ill patients in Slow County. On Valentine's Day, they're launching an offering called Letter Doula. Welcome, Dr. Beeman.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
How did you get the idea to start Dreammakers Slow?
Well, when we first started it, it was because we had seen a video of a gentleman who was 40 years old and he had a dream and wanted to dance with his daughter at Disneyland. His daughter was 4 years old and he had terminal brain cancer. And we had seen this video, and when they showed the video of him dancing with his daughter, there was a beautiful orchestra right in front of the castle at Disneyland, and the girl was all dressed up. And you know how little girls dance with their daddy standing on the shoes, and he was in a tux. And it was very moving, and my friend and I watched it, and of course we're moved by it. But then the person narrating the video said he asked to have it videotaped so that someday his daughter would have a dance with her dad at their wedding. And I was just like, oh my goodness. And my girlfriend and I at that point thought so many of our dreams have come true. We've been so blessed. And we thought about eight other friends of ours that have been so blessed. And we looked at each other and said, we have to do something like this for the people in our community. And thus Dreammakers was born. And that was about 8 years ago. We all threw in $100 and within 2 weeks had a dream for a young woman named Karina, who was in her 20s with muscle cancer. And I didn't even know there was such a thing as muscle cancer. And she only had a few months left to live, and she wanted to meet George Strait. And we're like, what? You know? And he was in Las Vegas. She'd never been on an airplane. She'd never had new clothes. She was the daughter of immigrant farm workers here. She had never had a haircut, never stayed at a hotel. She got all those things, and she got to meet George Strait and go to the concert and go backstage, sit in the front row, and then we were hooked. That you can play a small part in giving someone at the end of their lives who, for any number of reasons, hasn't had one of their lifelong dreams come true. If you can play a small part in doing that for them, what we've always said amongst ourselves and to people that are asking about us is we give that person something to look forward to, you know, something to think about instead of being ill. And then they get to do that thing. And for a while, they're not sick anymore. They get to go and experience going to Broadway and seeing Wicked and going backstage to see the actors, which just happened not long ago. And then at the end of your life, all of the people that we've been fortunate enough to make a dream come true for, all of them say the same thing, that all these strangers would get together and do this for me. The world is really a good place. And we've often felt like if you have to pass, that you pass knowing that the world is a good place is about as good as it gets.
Wow.
It's very moving work.
Yeah, it is. And I believe in Santa Barbara that you saw this video, right?
Correct.
So is there an organization already in Santa Barbara that also does this? And are you associated with them?
Yes. The organization where we first came across this idea is called the Dream Foundation in Santa Barbara. And it's a national, if not international, organization. And they do dreams all around the world and have a huge, you know, fund. And this is what they do. We spoke to them and asked, could we start a chapter even? And couldn't do that. They didn't do that. But they did tell us how to get started. Great. They gave us some of the bylaws and things like that. And so we've kind of gone rogue. And it's just, it's just for our community. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, like, our board is not a board, and no offense to boards that do this. Mm-hmm. We don't just sit around and talk about what should be done. The people that are on our board, we have 12 board members throughout the community, and we meet quarterly, and we actually do the dreams. We work. Mm-hmm. We make this happen. And we do the fundraising. We do all of it. And 100% of anything that's raised for Dreammakers goes to the dreams. We take no money for printing and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Everything goes to making those dreams come true.
How do you raise money and financially support people's dreams?
Well, a lot of times, this is such a great community. I don't need to tell you that. That a lot of times we just start begging. You know, can someone help us get a young mother with her 7-year-old son, and the mother is very, very ill, help us get her to Legoland. She's always wanted to take her son to Legoland. And someone will go, you can have my plane, I'll fly you down. You know, we get a lot of help from the community. Yeah. So we talk to all of our friends. We put it out there. People are generous like you with your time to give us a chance to let people know about it. So we really rely on that. And then, you know, we don't do any formal fundraisers. We ask companies, like we have a real estate company, Schwaggerly Real Estate. every month gives us 2% of their closing costs of anything they sold. And it's just this ongoing. We have a lot of ongoing, you know, and all those little amounts per month add up, since we're also relying on the community to step up and go, yes, I have a house in Yosemite that the family whose dad is dying, never seen Yosemite, you can stay at our house for free. So it's kind of a group effort between the community and our board. And I think everyone knows that their time will come. You know, we're all mortal. This happens to all of us in one way or another. And when given the chance to step up and help somebody whose time is sooner than they thought or imminent, everybody, this is a big-hearted community. And I think most people are really, really kind. And they just maybe somehow don't know how to be kind or where to be kind. And when you ask them and tell them something like this, we've never been turned down. And not only that, we've made every dream that ever came to us. We're almost on our 100th dream.
Wow.
We've made every single dream that came to us come true. We haven't turned anyone down or not been able to follow through and make it happen.
Just as you were talking, I was thinking it must require a lot of networking also within the community.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. So how long have you lived in the Central Coast?
Over 20 years. And I just started with people. I teach a lot of fitness classes. Okay. And so I started with all the people in my fitness classes going, we really want to start this. Would you guys help us? Would you be dream makers too? And everybody's like, yeah, you know. So we got a whole bunch of men and women from different fitness classes that I've been doing to help us. It's so weird because when this happened, I knew exactly who would help us. I knew exactly how the, and I'm kind of a driver. You know, I kind of make things happen. I didn't need to make this happen. It just was given to me in this vision. It sounds weird, but it was just like, I know what doctor will help us, and it's Dr. Tom Spillane here in town, leading oncologist that sends us patients. I knew who would help me, all my fitness classes, and then I knew who would be the board, all my best friends, and I could just see it, and I just thought, shame on me if I don't do this, you know? So it's really been just tapping people on the shoulder and going, will you help us? And everyone says yes.
Talk to us a little bit about the other people who are on the board.
They're all like movers and shakers in San Luis Obispo. And we have people who run their own mortgage companies. They are all entrepreneurs. They're all very busy. You know, it's not like they're sitting at home looking for something to do. These are all really busy, high achievement people. Andrews Real Estate, Karen Andrews is on our board. All these different people who are making space and time in their lives.
How many are there?
12 of us. We started out with 8 and now we're like big time. We have 12.
Can you talk about the kind of dreams that people have that they come to you to have them fulfilled?
It's so interesting. I've learned so much, and I think I speak for myself and everyone who's worked on any dreams for us. Whether you're watching Landy, who had brain cancer and wanted to meet Blake Shelton when he came to the fair, or whether you're talking about a small dream, like I just would like a massage chair because I'm in so much pain and my father is also dying of cancer and we could share that chair, you know, and you go deliver it to this small little house where there's multiple families and all they want is just to have a little bit of comfort, you know, so it ranges from all kinds of things. And when you are fortunate enough to be able to do this for someone, you learn so much about the human spirit. No one asks for something extreme or just for themselves or, you know, they really want to share. I can't do these things without crying, but they really just want to share it with people that they love and their families and their friends. And we're working on one right now that's a living funeral. And she's a very young woman, and she wants to be there when people say nice things about her, and she wants to say nice things back to people she's loved and bring her family there. And we're doing this beautiful thing thanks to one of our board members is letting us use Riata Ranch, which is this beautiful place in Santa Margarita.
And they'll stay at a beautiful, the ranch house at Riata. And we're going to have it catered. And we have two bands that are coming out. And, you know, they just want to be around the people that have meant something in their lives. The young woman I was telling you about that saw George Strait, she wanted to take her abuela. She wanted to take her grandmother with her. And, you know, when it all distills down to the essence is, who are the people in my life and what are the things I haven't had a chance to say or do that I would like to share with them? And it's magnanimous and it's loving and it almost leaves you speechless.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali talking to Dr. Rhonda Beeman about her nonprofit Dreammakers Slow. What is Letter Doula and how can people participate? Is it also only happening on Valentine's Day?
No, we're just launching it. So we're at letterdoula.com, and I'm writing a book currently called A Life in Letters, and it's letters that I should have written to people but never did. And so some of them are funny, some of them are not, but it started making me think, this is like my sixth book, I think, and I was going through these letters, and I was thinking, I wonder how many people feel like me, like I should have written to my first grade teacher, or I have things left unsaid to my dad, or whatever the case may be. And so we have a couple of very good and professional writers on our board, myself included, who, you know, we're doula, you know, they help you give birth or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we're giving birth to people's letters. We will help them write these letters. Our motto is we bring your letters to life, and we help people with their last thoughts. Or it doesn't even have to be that. It started out as that because it's in conjunction with Dreammakers. But, you know, if you're listening out there and you have something that you want to say to someone, something important, we will help you do that. And it's one of the last art forms left for every human being that you mm-hmm. could handwrite a letter. Mm-hmm. And we don't do it anymore. And I don't know about you, but when you get a handwritten letter, don't you save it?
Oh, my God.
It's like a sacred.
So special.
Yeah. So you save those, and we're losing that. So I'm trying to do my little part to keep people doing that and connecting that. That way. So I'll help you write a letter. And whether it's your last letter or whether it's a letter that you've been meaning to send, Dreammakers and their letter doula will help you do that.
So it's for anybody who's living in Slo County, and they can, what do they do? Do they sign a form online? Or
they actually can just go to letterdoula.com and it'll take you right to how to get a hold of Dreammakers and me and all that kind of stuff. So
there are probably moments that ask for a great amount of sensitivity and grace in the work that you're doing with Dreammakers. How do you approach these moments, and have there been any challenges related to it?
That's a great question, because it is, you know, it's very, everyone handles it differently. And I think that the people that are on our board, I knew what kind of people they were because they had been my friends, and I knew what kind of hearts they had, and they have the right mm-hmm. stuff to do this. Myself, I'm a crier, as you can see. And some people are some people are more emotionally stable than me or something. And, you know, they can go with someone and help them get a new outfit and watch them try it on. I will be over in the corner trying to hide that I'm crying because mm-hmm. it's so moving to me. So everybody handles it differently. But I think if a person is brave enough, and I mean it, I don't know what I would do if it was my last dream. And I don't know if I would allow myself to dream. I don't know how I would feel about strangers coming to help me with it. I don't know how I would act. And I think we know that going in. So some people might not be as open and, you know, outwardly thankful, but we know what's in their heart, because to have had the courage to dream, to have the courage to say, this is what I'd like to do before I go, that takes a special person. So we know that going in, and we honor however they want us to be. Some people are, you know, jovial and fun, and I just want to eat every rotten food at Disneyland there ever was, and I want to wear the, you know, the Minnie Mouse hat, and I want to go for it. Yeah. And some people are very, very sad. It's mm-hmm. very, very hard, but they would like to maybe reconnect with their son who they haven't seen in, you know, 20 years. So we just kind of play it by the tempo of the dreamer.
This is one thing that I haven't actually put it down, but is there any healing in the work that you do? or what does the word healing mean to you in the context of Dreammakers Slow?
I think that the word healing is really, really important because we know that what we do doesn't just affect the dreamer. It affects all their friends and their family and their community. We had one dream where a young woman wanted to celebrate her last Christmas with her three teenage children and husband and mother and father and brother and sister coming from different states, wanted to stay at this beautiful house in Avila. And we made it look like a Hallmark movie. I mean, there were Christmas trees in every room. We had It's a Wonderful Life playing on a projector out by the pool. We had a hot cocoa station. We had people come each day bringing food. They had matching pajamas and a photographer and all these, you know, crazy, wonderful, wonderful things. And the reason I bring up that story is the house was going to cost us $20,000 for the week. And then one of the woman's friends got her friends all to pitch in. And then we pitched in. And, you know, we made it happen. But at the end, the guy who owned the house came and saw what we had done. And he said, you don't have to pay us. You know, it's just, it ennobles everyone. It ennobles everyone who's part of it. And it makes us all better human beings. Because I always tell my students at Cal Poly, eye contact is so important. Because when you look at a person in their eyes, when you give them that dignity to really see a person, what you see is you. What you see is what makes us all human, the same fears, the same hopes, the same dreams. And I think that's what we do, too. We remind everybody of our humanity and what's possible out of kindness and love.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, we're really hoping that more people know about us because, you know, we just work with one oncologist here in town. And, you know, if you have a friend who's going through something like this or a family member and you didn't know about us, so I thank you for this opportunity because the more people that know about what we do, the more people we can help and make more dreams come true. And that's why we're doing this. So I just thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much, Dr. Beeman, for coming and talking to us. That was Dr. Rhonda Beeman of the nonprofit Dreammakers Slow. Their website is dreammakersslow.com. Letter Doula is their new project. Visit letterdoula.com for more information. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.